fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. And as always, hit that subscribe button, everybody. We had an amazing show for you all, because board the mothership is Michael O'Neill. You know him as Secret Agent Ron Butterfield on The West Wing. He recently played Victor McCleary in Echoes, available on Netflix. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. O'Neill. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Hey, it's nice to join you, Jeff.
It's totally my honor, sir. I've been a big fan of yours always since The West Wing.
Well, one of my very favorite shows. You know, you can tell a lot about a man about what, you know, what he watches. So I appreciate that we're on the same page there. That was a very, very important show for me.
For me, it's definitely one of my favorite shows. And I will say it's one of those comfort shows that I always go back to. I'm even rewatching it right now. Another thing on season two all over again.
No, I understand. I mean, there's always something to pick up in it, you know, and sometimes the dialogue was so fast. You have to hit stop, rewind to catch all of it. I mean, that repartee was really quick. But, you know, it was a wonderful company of actors to work with, you know, with a brilliant writing team, obviously, and a subject we all cared about. So it doesn't happen all the time.
I mean, did it just so happen that this is a show that found you, or did you seek out a show like that to be on?
You know, it's funny, Jeff, I had, when I first was introduced to the show, my agents called me, and Butterfield only appeared one time, one episode, Mr. Willis of Ohio, the sixth episode that they shot. And I said to them, are you crazy? This is the best writing on television. I don't want to go in for one. And they went, Michael, you just had twins. Which was true. My wife had just a little, she said, go to work. So I went in, and I had worked with John Spencer before. We had done a play together and also a film together. So my very first day, John took me by the hand. He played Leo. He took me by the hand and he introduced me to the rest of the cast. He was vouching for me. He's one of ours. And yeah. And from that moment on, you know, they treated me like I was part of the family. So we shot those scenes, and the script supervisor walked over to me and said, they like you upstairs. You'll be back.
Nice.
Now, can I tell you this, Jeff, as an actor, whenever they say that to you, you go, man, because you never go back. It's like, they mean, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that, and you never go back. They did. They kept bringing Butterfield back, thank goodness, because we had some great episodes together.
And you did such a wonderful job. I mean, your character, like I said, even though you didn't have so many scenes, the scenes you were in, you added so much to your character. You had poise. You felt like there was compassion there, like a true empathy for what you were doing. You had strength. You had this sense that you're going to kick someone's ass if they screwed with you in any given moment. I mean, that's a lot to put in a very short window of any given amount of dialogue or scenes. How did you do that?
Secret Service. Secret Service was really generous to me. You know, we were going back to Washington a lot. And I'm not the smartest actor out there, but I was smart enough to go to them and go, can I trail, you know, and they said, well, as much as we can allow it. Yeah. And they talked to me a lot. And, you know, I watched them carefully. Jerry Parr, who was the man who pushed Reagan in the limo when the shooting started and actually got him to George Washington Hospital and saved his life. Jerry Parr went through that entire incident with me, moment by moment, beat by beat. And I ultimately relayed that to Aaron, who then, of course, wrote it into The Shadow of the Gunman, part one and two. But I learned a lot from those guys. And more than that, they were heroic to me. We think of them as being, you know, protectors. But I don't think people understand that their first response is to cover and extract, which means they are to cover that president and extract him. Basically, they become a human shield. And I thought, what kind of person has that in them?
Right. So I really,
you know, more than anything, I wanted to pay homage to what they did and the dignity with which they did it. So that's what I was trying to do.
Now, when you're being around the Secret Service agents, you're trying to get a sense of their essence. What is it that you took away that was the prime aspect of these people who do a job like this, like, that you wanted to emulate in your character, Agent Butterfield?
Well, you know, they say that there are people that will step toward trouble.
Yeah.
There are people that, you know, there's, if we were talking about it in a primitive sense, they would stand at the mouth of the cave and say, you don't come in here. Mm. This is our tribe. You don't come in here. You don't hurt them. And that's kind of who they were in a modern day sense. They were they were the people that protected the tribe. Mm. So I had such regard for them. And I've talked to a lot of them. I maintain contact with a lot of them and see them from time to time, you know, and it's just, I don't know what it is. And I've heard it said that there's a very specific part of the brain in those people. And you see it in other people as well, that will step into a situation, triage somebody who's hurt, or step in when a shooter's, you know, involved and address the shooter. Whatever that is very specific, and they seem to have it. And I wanted to try to portray it, you know, if I could.
Now, you know, I mean, I understand. I mean, I'm married to my lovely wife, and I can understand, you know, and I hope in the situation calls for it, I'd protect my wife and stand in front of my wife. But these secret agents are standing in front of people who are not that, or not connected to them in that way. They're not family. They're not children, parents, whatever. Are they, when they're putting in their head to protect these people, are they protecting the person? Are they protecting the station? Are they protecting an ideal? What is it that drives them to want to protect the individual?
It's an interesting question, Jeff, and I agree with you. You know, I mean, I think there's something in all of us that would protect our spouse or our child, right, or something. But when you're talking about that, a lot of it has to be training. I mean, there, you know, the selection process, there are a lot of people that apply to the Secret Service, and whatever that testing looks like, you know, and I really don't know what that aspect of it is. But I think what they find ultimately are those people that can be trained into the responsibility of it. And I think initially it's protecting the position of the state, the office of the president. But it can't help but become personal because you spend so much time. And although I do know this, we stop hearing, we stop listening. You know, when you're in that car with them and they're talking business of the nation, that's not your purview as a Secret Service agent. Your purview is if anything happens, you take care of POTUS. So I think part of it is training, but I do think eventually it becomes personal.
Mm. So when you're playing Agent Butterfield, and like I said, there's so many great scenes that you had in there. Like I said, the shot of two gunmen. Once again, you sit when you're in the car and you're talking about, you know, and he's talking about, you know, that you're look at your hand. You're like, no, I'm fine. All this other stuff. But the scene that kind of gets me, and I'm going to probably get the dialogue exactly wrong, but I think it's in the second episode, or it could be this, when you're talking to Toby, and Toby's upset about the canopy, and you're like, you know, and you're trying to make him feel better. He's talking about your hand being shoved. You're like, you're trying to comfort him. That's such a wonderful scene. I mean, can you kind of talk to me through a little bit about what that was like to perform, what you were thinking when you were doing it?
Sure. You know, I mean, I had other considerations besides Toby, because we start that scene with me saying, get those people back. And if they try to move in again, cuff them to the parking meters. Right. Yeah. And then Toby and I start the walk, and he starts talking to me about, you know, the canopy. He was concerned about the canopy. And the response to that, ultimately, I thought it was an interesting piece of writing that Aaron did. He said, I would never let you not let me do my job.
Mm.
So that was, for me, the thematically what the scene was about. You don't have to worry. I am going to do my job, Toby, at all costs. And you do your job. That was a decision that you made inside your job. And that's not what the president, that's not why he got shot. And when I talked about, you know, we had the shooters down in 3.2 seconds from the time the first shot went off. So people did their jobs. And then one of my favorite lines in that scene, Jeff, and sometimes when somebody comes up to me, you know, and they're a West Wing fan, and they'll say, I love Butterfield. I go, sorry, Secret Service doesn't comment on procedure.
Oh, yeah. You know, just... I mean, it was so perfect. And I mean, the timing, the repartee you have with Toby's, the character, I totally forgot the guy's name off my head. I feel bad.
Richard Schiff.
Richard Schiff. Thank you so much. And I've watched the show many times, I totally forgot the actor's name. But I mean, it's perfect. The dialogue, and it's the snappy dialogue as well. I mean, it is a poetry to how well these words bounce off each other.
We knew we had something special, Jeff, in terms of, you know, Aaron's brilliant. Sorkin is brilliant. I don't know any other way to describe it, because nobody writes quite that way. And he was also, he had the benefit of having a lot of New York actors that understood what an ensemble was. All those guys had worked stage. A lot of them had worked stage together. Alice and Janney came off the stage. Richard did. Martin had that experience in New York. Brad Whitford was a wonderful stage actor. So when they were together, they knew it, you know, and Spencer was a guy in New York, Jeff. When Spencer did a play, there'd be a hum in the theater community. Hey, John Spencer's doing a play over at Manhattan Theater Club. Spencer's going to be on stage at Circle Rep. It was like we all wanted to see what that guy was going to do next. He was that good. He was like, okay, what's John going to do with this role, you know? So my point is that they were a great ensemble, you know, and they cared about one another as a company of actors. And they realized, they knew, they had great writing on their hands. And you don't always get that. So that was a special time for all of us.
When you're a recurring character and you show up on the show with these actors who have that great chemistry with all each other, you know they've been doing it for a while, the snap of the dialogue, the timing. How do you jump in? And it's almost like taking the relay race, like in the moment where it's at the peak of its race and you're jumping in. How do you jump into that timing?
You know, I mean, if you look at my resume, you know, been a guest on a lot of shows over the years, and it's different. It's different for each one, but you're right. They have a shorthand. It's their show, their crew. They're being written for in rhythm. So you're trying to find a way in. Now, my way into the West Wing was the fact that John Spencer took me by the hand and introduced me to everybody. You know, that being vouched for that way, that I've never had that. That's the only time that's ever happened. Mm. But sometimes you have to figure out a way. When you're a guest, your job is to lift some of the weight of the story off those lead actors, because they're grinding it out week after week after week. So you come in, at least as a guest like that, my job is to kind of help them move that story and take some of the weight off and hopefully be involved in the turn. And when I say that, I mean, there's going to be an event that happens, and once it happens, you can't go back. Right. You don't go back. It's the turn of the play. It's the turn of the script. It's, you know, and you want to be involved in that. Sometimes you get very quiet and just let it come to you. Sometimes you go in and compliment them, tell them how much you've enjoyed watching them, you know, so you disarm them a little bit. I'm not sure I want you to quote me on that one, but you have to, whatever the way is, you know, you have to find your way in, because you are the guest. They are the regulars. It's their show, their crew, their time. And you just do the best you can with each one. And occasionally it doesn't work out. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, rare. And it's even more rare because I've been doing it a long time and they know me now. You know, they know what I can do. They've seen me in other shows. So they're like, oh, okay. Yeah, come play with us, you know. but in the early days, it was harder.
The show, West Wing's been off for a while. I'm trying to remember when we're talking maybe almost 15 years, 17 years, something like that.
Yeah,
it's been off for
2007, six or seven, we came out. Yeah, finished up.
And the show is still talked about, praised. I mean, for me, it's one of those comfort shows where I loop it way more than I probably should, but I love it so much. What is it like to know you're a part of something that, in many ways, the West Wing kind of has a fan base that's sort of almost like Star Trek and Stargate, you know, but for the West Wing, what is that like for you?
It was important for me for a couple of reasons. And it's very important that I'm considered part of that, because it was historic in terms of television. The conventional wisdom in Hollywood was that you cannot make a show about DC. You just can't do it. And Aaron, in that mind of his, must have gone, well, we'll see. Because he made it, and it, you know, I think it won like 4 Emmys in a row, best show. It won a Peabody. It just, you know, all kinds of good things came toward that show. It's wonderfully historically to have been part of it. It was important for my career because as an actor in Hollywood, I always say there's a membrane, you know, And as an actor, you get through that membrane and you get to work, and then you get pushed back out. The West Wing pushed me through the membrane, and it wouldn't let me out again. There was no, you know, once I was, because of that show, once I was in, you know, it was a remarkable kind of community and validation. And then people wanted to, you know, they wanted to work with Butterfield, I guess.
And I think the great thing is too, as a fan, I mean, no matter how you cynical you can be, you look at the West Wing and the people, you know, the characters, and you think, God, I wish these were real people. I wish the president was like that. I wish the chief of staff cared that much and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
It's like a beautiful political fantasy, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, it's aspirational, I think, about what Washington could, D.C. could be.
Yeah,
and people like to think that that's the government in service at its best. Mm. There is an entire generation, Jeff, in Washington, D.C., that went there because of the West Wing. They went to be of service to the United States of America because they saw that show and they saw the possibility of what they could do. And there are a lot of them that are still there. I mean, it's, you know, the numbers have diminished over the years, but I met a lot of young people and they were there because of the show, because we filmed a lot there. So I thought that was quite a profound impact to have on the working machinery of government.
I think it is, especially because it is from a good place. It's not, you know, about the power of the position. It's not about the cynical nature of it. It really comes from a good place. That show is trying to encourage you, you know.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, so much of, I don't know, on some levels, whenever it's a, you know, popularity contest or you have to win an election, it's about me.
Yeah.
You know, look at me, what I did. Here's what I did. And there was something in that show that transcended that. It was about us.
And I think also what I loved about it is that they weren't perfect. They wasn't like every episode was like, hey, they won the day. Sometimes they lost. Sometimes they lost badly. And that was part of the point too. You know, they kept trying, they failed, but it was always the day that tomorrow we're giving it another shot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We'll suit up and show up again. Yeah. I agree with you. That was interesting. He did that. And Aaron would take, you know, advice from both sides of the political spectrum. He would sit down and talk. I know Dee Dee Myers was on one side, but there was a Republican operative that was, I can't think of his name right now, Jeff, I'm sorry. But they would have long discussions about stuff and different points of view. Mm-hmm. And then Aaron would go away and write the show. And he ended up bringing characters on. I remember Emily Proctor came on the show.
So, yep.
You know, you remember that?
Oh, yeah, I do. Ainsley Hayes. So
Yeah. So there was an attempt, I think, at dialogue, you know, at a conversation about what the possibilities are and the difference of opinion.
And I remember when the show first came out, I didn't watch the show when it first came out. It came out right around the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky thing. I was thinking, oh, Jesus Christ. You know, I was like, what is this going to, you know, and I thought to myself, what is, you know, this is going to be one of those shows that are going to try to milk off what was going on with that. And I came into it very cynically. I think it took a couple of seasons in before some people kept talking. I was like, all right, I'm going to check this out. And I was surprised by it. Now, knowing what the show is in that perfect moment that it came out of, do you think the show would have lasted or would have made it to TV if it came out now? Do you think people could have accepted or would have been too cynical nowadays?
You know, it may have been too optimistic. Mm. It may have been the other side of that coin. Because, you know, there's always a dissonant scale in an audience. If you tip too far, they just stop believing. And I think that we were in a period of time when people actually believe government might be able to function that way. I don't know about right now. I just don't know. You know, it might be a wonderful example and it may get traction that way. Okay, this is our better selves. This is how we should be.
Right.
But, you know, we've taken some hits here lately, so I don't know.
You know, and because looking at, so I frequent social media, obviously, and the West Wing Facebook group, stuff like that. And the one thing everyone talks about because of the streaming era we're in is bringing back the show, bring back the West Wing. And people, a lot of people talk about it. And I keep wondering, like, if you did, could you make it the West Wing still? And I'm thinking, especially after the last 4 years, maybe 6 years ago or so, that people would be thinking, unless it really got dirty, I don't know if people would have accepted it.
Yeah, I don't know how it would play in this environment. I agree with you because things have gotten you know, I've heard before politics are a blood sport, but there have been so many elbows thrown, you know, in the last 6 years that and the timber of what's you know, the what we used to consider a decorum that you didn't break, that a lot of that's been shattered. So I just don't know if the wing would have the opportunity to get the traction in this environment. And then again, it might be exactly what's needed for people to go, oh, wait a minute, let's take a break. Let's step back here and see if we can figure out a way to unravel the knot we've gotten ourselves into.
Right.
I'd love to find out.
I would too. I think it would be a great show. And I think you listen to the Facebook groups are constantly like, you know, Sam would be the president or Jimmy Smith would have to come back and be the president. I mean, there's so many great characters that you could bring back. Yeah. And there's so many stories to tell because, once again, history keeps moving. There's always something else now to argue and discuss. I want to see it, but unfortunately, I have no power.
Well, let me put it this way. I'm glad there's still an appetite.
Indeed.
I'm glad there's still interest and an appetite for it. I think it speaks to a touchstone of something, you know, in our culture that there's an interest in, if I dare say, a hunger for.
I think so. I mean, the Facebook groups, I mean, the fact that every episode is analyzed and stared at and pulled apart, it tells you there's that desire for it. And it's quoted. There's always, you can always quote the West Wing in any given situation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? But there's a legion of people that have done that. And now with social media, the presence is, it's elevated again.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Another time. I'm glad you continue to watch it though, because it is inspiring.
You know, it always gets better. I mean, some episodes I appreciate more than other ones. Some, you know, I tend to rewatch more, you know, more than I had used to. But I don't know, it always makes me happy. In a rough day at work, come home, West Wing, you know, old friends, see how they're doing.
Yeah. It's funny, my oldest daughter came home from high school one day, a civics class she had in high school. She said, "Dad, you were on the TV today in my civics class." I said, "What?" She said, they used the West Wing as an example for something. And I said, "Well, how did you handle that?" She said, "I just kept my mouth shut. No one said."
well, I know in the hallway of the school, because I'm the English teacher. So in the hallway of the school, I use a quote from the West Wing where they quoted somebody else. I'm trying to remember the exact quote, but something along the lines of, it was in Dead Irish Writers was the name of the episode. And the character played by the British ambassador at the time says, I'm trying to remember exactly what the quote was. History, but it's the one where he's Toby talking to the British ambassador and dead Irish poets, and he's using a quote about how history, there's no past, there's no future, just now happening over and over again, something along those
over
lines.
Again, yes.
And yeah. I have that on the wall, and I'm thinking about that is a perfect quote.
It is, and you know, it's sobering if one takes it in,
yeah,
you know, because we can affect the now. I mean, we obviously can't do anything, you know, about history. There's a wonderful Robert Frost poem that I learned when I was a young actor, something to the effect that we live more in the past than in the future. No, we live more in the future than in the present, and less in both together than in the past.
Oh, that's great.
The present is too much for the senses, too crowding, too confusing, too present to imagine, you know. And I thought, yeah, I guess we do live in the past a lot. You know, it's hard to stay in the present.
No, I agree with you 100%. I will say I wish as the, because sometimes now that I'm in a new school right now, I just started where I teach to a drug. It's a drug and recovery school that I teach at. So now I'm the only teacher. So I teach all the subjects for the most part. And for history, you know, the West Wing's popping up. When I talk about social studies and history, it's got to pop up. But yeah. And that's why I think it would be good for new episodes, because sometimes kids tune out what's old. If they can tell that's an old looking, they'll immediately try to tune it out a little bit. But yeah, it'd be nice if something was new with some newer, fresher voices and they could, you know, watch it.
In the good class. For you, by the way, for doing that work. That's not easy.
Thank you.
I've spent some time in that world, and it's not easy, but incredibly rewarding to see somebody get their life back. You know what I mean?
What did you do when you mean you did spend some time? Is it as a mentor, as a teacher, as
well? Yeah, there was a halfway house in Birmingham when I lived there, and I was involved with, you know, work working with them a bit and also raising money for them and stuff like that. I don't think we realize the degree and the depth of the problem in this particular halfway house. It was mothers. Mm. So when you can get a mother back on the right path, then you're affecting their children, which is affecting the future.
Right.
You know? And so it was incredibly rewarding work. And I remember talking to some, what they call diversion courts, drug courts, about the work that they were doing. I spoke at a conference of drug court professionals, and hard work, hard, you know, you have to be willing to live with failure. Mm-hmm. But when you get those successes, and they're more, you know, as they come. Anyway, I just want to say I respect very much that you're doing that.
One thing I did always wonder, you know, a lot of the characters you do play are very strong characters, you know, very confident. Why do you think you fit those roles so well? Is it from a past that you've built upon, or is it an air that you've been able to just portray all the time?
You know, I think people project things on you sometimes. Honestly, you know, Jeff, it's the mustache. They see mustache, they think military, they think CIA, they think FBI, they think, you know, police, law enforcement, something like that. That's part of it, and part of sense of calm or an ability to take charge and step into a situation as opposed to, you know, running away from it. So I think whatever it's hard to define from inside out. I don't know exactly, but from the outside in, I'm guessing that they just, you know, they see something that, they believe that they can take charge of it and fix it. It's funny because a couple of times in my career, I've had that flipped where as opposed to being the problem solver, I was the problem. And it's interesting, you know, to as an actor, you want to be able to play a lot of different stuff. But I suspect it has to do sort of with bearing and appearance. You know, I know I spent enough time. I wasn't in the military. I came out of college at the time that Vietnam was winding down. I was eligible and actually had a very, very low number. And they basically said, we don't want you.
Really?
We're in force reduction right now. So you're not going in. Because I thought I was. But I had spent time in ROTC. I'd spent time with a lot of military people. I'd been to Fort Benning and done some, you know, rappelling and jump school kind of stuff. And so I knew the military environment pretty well. And so those roles, you know, I knew how to replicate what I'd seen, maybe. Imitate.
Now, sometimes, I mean, I know sometimes people, fans, confuse fiction with reality, especially with actors. Now, because of the characters you've played, have you seen that fans of yours are intimidated by you or intimidated to go up to you and be like, oh, you know, hey, Mr. Renee, or do you think they just are able to be like, hey, no, he's just cool?
You know, it's funny. Probably a little bit of both, a little bit, but for the most part, I think, you know, I'm pretty much a knucklehead in life. Yeah. So, you know, if they want to talk, I'll talk to them. You know, there's nothing standoffish about me. I don't usually see them see me. If my wife is with me, she'll clock it, you know, and, you know, they'll finally kind of peek over and go, excuse me, could I get a picture of my wife? Just hand me your phone, honey. And she'll snap the shot. But,
oh, that's very nice of you. Some actors are very standoffish about that kind of stuff. That's pretty cool of you.
You know, I worked with an old character actor when I was just starting out, a character actor named Will Gear. Played the grandfather on The Waltons. A lot of people don't remember because we're talking about the 70s, early 70s. But Will always said, it's much more important for you to be interested in them than for them to be interested in you. It'll make you a better actor. And I didn't understand fully at the time, but I understand what he's talking about in terms of, you know, as an actor working with another actor, you're totally dependent on them for your performance. So you better be interested in what's going on. And he said, just, you know, be interested in people. You'll learn a lot. So that's sort of the course I've tried to follow.
Well, right now you're playing Victor McCleary in the TV show Echoes on Netflix, which is,
yes, sir.
You did a fantastic job in it, by the way. I thought you were awesome.
Thank you.
So how did you get involved with the show, and what intrigued you about it?
I had worked with Michelle before, so I knew what kind of actor she was. And I had worked with the executive producer, Quentin Peoples, before, and I knew what kind of exec and writer he was. So when the opportunity came up, there really wasn't a whole lot. There was not a hesitation at all, quite frankly. I was in a bit of a unique position because in life, I have identical girls. I have identical twin girls. And you know, the device of Echoes, the story is that these girls swap lives. Mm. And they do it all the way into adulthood, which means they're swapping families and swapping locations, which ultimately is a big problem. When one of the twins disappears, you know, the construct begins to collapse on itself, and the other tries to keep it elevated by playing both twins. Mm. Difficult at best. And I play their father. Well, I'd seen my girls, you know, swap roles.
Really?
Just to, you know, when they were little, they would do it as a, you know, just to see what they could get away with sometimes, you know. But the notion to me of that going into adulthood, that's damage.
Mm.
And what's happened in the show is it's created tremendous suspense. It's a suspense thriller.
Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, once you start it, I was like, oh my God, you know, and I'd shot it and I was still kind of like leaning toward the television. And they lose their mom, you know, early. And I think that blinds the father to what's going on. He lost his partner and he was overwhelmed by having three daughters, you know. And so he really lost the ability to discern that they were doing that, you know. I it's a lovely show, wonderful cast, you know, Matt Bomer, Karen Robinson, David Sanjay. Good people, good play.
Well, one interesting part about the show is that the father can't tell that they're swapping. Now, as a father of identical twins, can you figure it out? Are you able to do it?
Well, you know, there have been times that they fool me, even as they got older. And I don't know that they meant to fool me. What always confused me, Jeff, they would swap personality traits.
Mm.
And when that happened, I couldn't tell them apart. And, you know, pretty soon they would swap back. I think it was an organic thing, you know, some sort of a mimicking. I don't really know what causes that because, you know, nobody knows why that egg splits.
Mm.
They don't know. They still don't know. They know certain aspects of twindom based on when it splits, like mirror image twins, that happens at a certain time, you know. It was kind of fascinating to me that's when I simply couldn't tell them apart. And it wasn't that they would look different. Mm. They looked different. Didn't matter. They'd swap personality traits, and that fooled me.
Mm. Now, the one interesting about you doing the performance, and I'm trying not to, I'm being careful of spoilers here, so
yeah,
I'm going to tiptoe a little bit.
Thank you.
There's an element about the father that's questionable throughout the show until the last episode.
Yes.
It has to do with the integrity or whatever of the father. I think that's the closest I can go to it without spoiling it. So when you're doing the performance, you need to make both possibilities possible. So how do you walk a line where you can make both things seem both equally true and equally impossible at the same time?
Hardest part of the job. I mean, you define the problem of the character, really.
Yeah.
And then how you go about dropping a clue here and dropping a clue there, and then dropping a cover here and dropping a cover there. And I hope I was successful in doing it. I imagine the editor was more successful at it than I. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
God bless editors, man. They've saved a lot of us. But yeah, it really was the difficulty of that character was that he held something in his history that ultimately is important, but you can't tip it.
I will say I was unsure until the very end on what the reality of it was, and on some level, I mean. depending on how you feel about the two main characters, Gina and Lainey, you do wonder which one is their reality, because they're telling the story, you know, you get the truth through them, but they're questionable too, and based on how they behave. So you're still kind of up in the air, like, well, you know, are we trusting this character then or that character? They're both at that point unreliable.
Yeah, that's a fascinating piece of writing, really. Yeah. To lead, you know, as to do that to an audience, and Michelle's performance, quite frankly, was stunning and really difficult to do. She's ostensibly playing four characters. You know, she's playing one twin being the other twin, and vice versa. And I would agree with you that you know, it is a suspense. It's also a mystery, and ultimately a thriller. Mm. So, you know, if you were describing it in the byline, you know, a Netflix byline, that's probably what would come up, suspense thriller, but it's a mystery.
Now, I don't think this is a spoiler because it happens pretty early in the show. So if it is, welcome to tell me to cut it and I'll cut it.
Okay.
It's revealed that the character has an illness. That I think this happens early in the first couple of episodes. So it's not
early.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's a total spoiler because it's kind of early. So when you're also playing that aspect of a character, are you playing, there's a vulnerability when you know a character knows it has that kind of illness to it. How do you incorporate that as well?
Well, there's certain physical aspects of it that you want to honor. But again, you only want to plant the seed of it. You know, you don't want the audience sort of going, oh, is that, you know. Mm. What I loved about the way it was presented, Jeff, was he played it off a little bit, as any father would.
Mm.
You know, if you're confiding in your daughters, you don't want to make it a huge deal. You just, you know, you just tell them this is what it is, and so this is what I'd like. And it was an interesting, as the challenge of the actor was how much to bring it to bear. Mm-hmm. How much did it affect? How much did you see it? When did you see it? And I had long conversations with the head writers about it, you know, because I thought it should show up at one point. They said, no, we don't really want it there. We want it later. I said, you know what? You're the boss. I do what you say.
So when you do go with, like I said, the writers, you had this idea and the writers had that idea, how easy to incorporate what someone else wants from what you want to do with your character?
Well, if you have a really strong, you know, if you know in your heart of hearts that character has that going on, you better fight for it. You better get your shoulder behind it and fight for it. In this particular instance, because of the nature of the way the mystery was playing out, I wanted to make sure that I meshed with the mystery. And so it made more sense to try to accommodate their overall understanding of how our journey took place. Mm. So it wasn't, you know, I wasn't squashed at all. They didn't go, no, you can't do it. No. You know,
yeah.
When somebody does that, you tend to bridle a little bit and go, well, we'll see. We'll see if I'm going to do that. You know, but they were quite helpful and informative about why they were trying to move it along the way that they were moving it along. And then I thought, oh, okay, now I understand. I understand how that, you know, affects the story or doesn't affect the story. But, you know, I heard a director once say, I never won an argument with an actor. If I won, I lost. You know, and, really? And what he was basically saying is if you yank an actor's instinct away from him, you're just not going to get the performance you might have got.
Mm. I had an interview a couple of weeks back with a guy, William B. Davis, who wrote a book on acting, on acting in life. It was the name of the book. And he talks a lot about the actor and the objective and how the difficulty of acting with a director sometimes the idea of being the director needs to kind of almost butt out of what the actor wants to do. As the actor, how do you, I guess, build the rapport with a director where you're both feeling like you're accomplishing something?
Yeah. You know, I like the collaboration. I think the very nature of what we do is collaborative. You know, I'm collaborating with a writer. Mm. I'm collaborating with a director. I'm collaborating with another actor. So the nature of it is collaborative for me. And I generally find that those suggestions, unless I just find them dead wrong and I go, you know what? I don't know how to do that. Mm. I don't know how to do what you're saying. It's not in this character. Mm. Right. And usually, if they're hearing me, they go along. Rarely, Jeff, have I been in a situation where somebody would say something. What happens sometimes is that a director confuses you. You know, they have a direction that just confuses you. And and so what I find is I just go, oh, yeah. And then I go do what I was going to do. You know, because if you go, oh, yeah, then they go, okay, he heard me. Great. Now go back to Video Village. But if you go, no, that's bullshit. I'm not doing that. Then you're going to stand there and, you know, jaw back and forth until neither one of you are happy. So I just go, oh, yeah, okay. And then I go do my thing. And he'll go, okay, yeah, it's not quite it. You get that? Yeah, okay, okay. And then I do it again. And finally he gets tired. He's got cut. Let's go. Move on. That's our secret. You know, there's some directors going to go, that son of a bitch.
Well, one decision I imagine you had to make playing Mr. McCleary is that when you're looking at the family, okay, so we know what happens to the mother without giving too much away. The character Gina is very troubled. Then you have Lainey and the other daughter, I forgot the other daughter's name, who's in the wheelchair, who is due to...
Yeah, Alex Stoker is that actress. God, she was wonderful.
Yeah.
Bless her. Yeah.
So as you're playing the character, do you interpret whether or not he thinks he was a good father or not?
That's a great question, Jeff. I don't know if I ever asked myself that question. I think I knew that I loved my girls. And I looked, you know, as a single parent who also was dealing with the loss of the woman that he loved, which, you know, they all lost. The children certainly lost, but Victor lost as well. And I don't know that he handled his own grief well enough. I think he didn't see a lot that was happening with the girls because of his own grief.
So the question was, do you think he considered himself, or when you're playing him, did you consider that he was thought of himself as a good father?
You know, I thought he thought of himself as an adequate father. I thought of him as a present father. You know, he missed a lot in his presence because he was a single dad and he was working a ranch. So there was a lot growing up. He just took for granted that they were okay, and they weren't. Mm. They weren't. You know, but I don't think he thought he was bad. I think he just went by.
Mm. Like too busy to notice, basically, how that works? Mm-hmm.
Or too preoccupied, or too hurt, or too much in his own grief to realize, you know, what was happening with the twins, certainly. You know?
I mean, that must have been a very complicated thing to play. I mean, that's a lot going on, and, you know, going on there, because you have a character, once again, you had the illness, the event that we are not going to fully go into for spoiler reasons. Then you have, once again, a very complicated situation that, and the failure on some level of from parenting becomes noticeable as the story unfolds. Yeah. And you have to kind of deal with that realization as the actor as well, that here's a guy who maybe, even if he wasn't always present, tried or cared, and now he's seeing what came from that, and it's not good. None of it's good.
Yeah, you know, Jeff, it's funny, as a parent, somebody said to me when my girls were first born, and we had three girls in 18 months, so there was rain children for a minute. But I remember somebody saying, nobody gets out of childhood uninjured. Mm. And then they said, and nobody gets out of parenthood uninjured either.
I can believe that.
Yeah, you know, you make mistakes. If I could go back, I would do it differently. You know, when they were little, I thought I was shaping them to be something better than I was. Mm. I learned as I got older, my job was to just shape them to be who they were. Mm. you learn.
That must be the rough thing about parenting, is that you learn as you go, and by the time you learn it, you've already made a mistake to begin with. And that's the unfortunate thing about life, I guess. The moment you learn it, you realize where the mistake came earlier on.
Yeah. And we all got them.
Yeah.
The question was, you know, how much benevolence was in there and how much something else was in there. But, you know, I think in response to your question that Victor kind of did the best he could. He didn't realize that the root was twisting.
Mm.
If he had, he probably would have done something about it.
Mm.
I mean, it was that maybe.
Yeah.
You know, I'll never know. I rely on those writers a lot because they give me the path. They give me the footprint, the blueprint, and I try to follow it.
I will say, as the viewer and fan, I kind of wish, without giving spoilers away, there was more of the father scene after one of the major reveals, and see what would come of that. Because I feel like there's so much more interesting things going on with that father, what you could have done with it, and unfortunately there wasn't as many scenes as I would like at that after that point in time of the story.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I understand the family aspect of it. There could have been more reveal there, but when you're working in mystery or suspense, the pace of edit has a lot to do with setting the tone of that. And I remember watching my wife when we were watching it together, Jeff, she couldn't hold still. She was like, so she kept shifting. She'd get up, she'd sit down, and I was like, gotcha, didn't it? She said, yeah. But it, you know, the pace has a lot to do with it.
It does draw you in. I think when I first started watching, I was like, what? And then over time, you start getting sucked in. You're like, oh, this is working, you know, because I think the premise is kind of weird to get your brain around as the first episode. You're just like, wait, what? For how long? No way. Yeah, I don't know how that would work. And then after a while, when you start getting sucked into it, and when the swapping starts happening very rapidly, you start forgetting who's who as well. And you start going, oh, shit. And then you start thinking about perception and point of view and everything else. It gets really kind of heady later on.
Yeah, it's very layered. I agree with you. I mean, I had the same experience. I would turn to Mary and say, is that Gina or is that Lenny? Or is that Gina playing Lenny or Lenny playing Gina? You know, and Mary goes, just shut up and watch the show.
Right. I would say, there's one line, I can't remember which character. I don't think the story is supposed to say which character really says it, where the character mentions, I don't even remember anymore necessarily which one I'm supposed to, you know, so something along those lines. I don't even remember anymore which one I am, or necessarily, you know what scene I'm talking about? Like, I think it was
yeah, dude,
the
and
end.
That's a very, yeah.
And I'm thinking myself, right. I'm thinking myself, oh shit, that is a possibility with all the switching. It's possible you lose yourself that to a certain point where you don't even necessarily remember which one you're supposed to be in a very, not, maybe not necessarily, you may know who you are, but who that personality is so been rewatched. Right. It's buried.
You know, you can get lost.
Right.
You know, you can get lost. And that's a great danger. This, you know, I think the show works on a lot of levels in that regard. It is, you know, you can watch it as a mystery. You can watch it as the thriller because of the nature, you know, there's betrayal and there's a con game going on and there's all kind of stuff, but you know, you can unravel it at a lot of levels because of, you know, the family stuff. Where does that, there's a seed here and a seed there, if you pick that up. You know, when I think about the performance, Matt Bomer, I watched his performance in that thing and went, geez, that guy's a good actor. They're all good. You know, they really are. You know, there's an old saying, if you want to play class baseball, play with class baseball players.
Right, right.
So I got to play with some class baseball players in this one.
I mean, I think it seemed like there was a hint of a season two. Do you think that's going to happen, or was there a discussion of it?
Well, you, yes. I'm not saying yes to a season two. There was certainly a discussion because I think seeds are planted of a possibility. Now, whether or not they want to do that or can do it is another, you know, it's another matter. It's above my pay grade, Jeff. I'd be just about the last one to know.
Well, like I said, I thought it was great. And another great, Karen Robinson was also phenomenal in as well. And I thought she did, this did a wonderful performance, and I wanted to see you two with some scenes, more scenes together. I think you have like one or two scenes together. I think just
we do. We do have a couple of scenes together, and I liked, you know, it's funny you say that because Karen and I spent a lot of time together. You know, we worked on that job for almost five months, and so Karen and I, you know, we would go to dinner together, or we'd go exploring around Wilmington, or you know, just, and so I got to know her really well, and we became friends. But I love her performance in this. Mm. You know, she's just, she's a lovely actress. She's a really, really lovely human being.
Mm. So for our listeners, it's on Netflix for anyone who wants to find it. And if you have a few minutes, I just want to ask about one other project that apparently you're a part of. I've not seen it though, but I've heard of it. It's called Bound, and it's a short film, and I heard that you're producing it. So you want to discuss a little bit about that? And
yeah, I'm happy to tell you about it. A dear friend of mine, Mike Panuski, he and I did a film together 25 or 30 years ago, and he's just one of those actors I always watch, Jeff. I'm mindful of him when he's working. He's incredibly honest. Whenever he steps on screen, you know, I just know, okay, things just got solid. Panuski's in this. And so we had talked about doing something together, and about 3 years ago, he called me and said, Michael, you still interested? I said, of course I am, Mike. Of course I am. And he had written this piece about two brothers after their father passes. The father had been really hard on them, so they were estranged. It was not a happy family. But the father dies, and they're forced to come back together to deal with the father's effects. So the short film is that time of coming together, There's a lot of weather and something like that in a family. And so we did it. His wife, Jay, directed it. He wrote it. And Mary and I, my wife and I, were producers on it along with them. But it's in the festival circuit now. It's been submitted to different festivals. And we're going to go and we'll see how it does.
Very cool. I do have one question, because I read the summary on IMDb. And it said, the brothers must make a life and death choice. Can you expand on what that choice refers to?
Not without tipping the 10 minutes or the 12 minutes. But they're forced into a crucible pretty quickly. And they have to deal with it. One way or the other, they must deal with it. And, you know, the father had not died. I don't know that they would have come together at that moment to have to do that, but they do. And so that's the conflict in the play, in the piece, and how do they resolve it? And you know what's strange about it, Jeff? The more research we did, there's a lot of estrangement in families. There's a tremendous percentage of families that are estranged. It's painful. It's just painful to think that there's no way back. So this little film poses a question. How do you get back?
Now, some short films are proof of concept and they're looking for, you know, to make a feature length. Others are to show your aptitude. You know, I'm a good producer, I'm a good director, I'm a good actor. Now, what Bound, which does it fall into? Are you proving that you're producing and do more producing? Is it a proof of concept to do a feature film?
No. It's neither of those things. It was something that we had in us that we wanted to explore. And so we explored it on film. And then, you know, once we had the film that we'd shot, we made our film. You know, they always say there's the film you write, the film you shoot, then there's the film you edit. And so we have it, you know, I mean, we got as much as we could have gotten out of that script, quite frankly. So it's you know, it's not a showcase. People either know who I am or they don't. They're not going to know more about who I am from this film. I'm not using it as a calling card. It was just an exercise in what I think of as creativity with Mike, you know, for us to get a chance to work together again.
So regular people like me, how do we get to see it?
You know, pay attention to the film festivals that are around you, and hopefully it'll be in one of those. I think we've got a decent shot at that. And then eventually, after the festivals have all gone away, we'll create a link to it, Jeff. And then, you know, you can see it that way.
Very cool. I hope for the opportunity to go see it. I want to thank you so much, Mr. O'Neill. This was well above my expectations. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long while. Thank you so much.
Jeff, I enjoyed it. Thanks so much, bud.
Thank you. Have a great night, sir.
You too.